You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I'm going to continue last week's show in a way, re-listening to the show from last week while making the podcast, which went up a little bit late. If you're a follower of the podcast, sorry for the wait, but it is online now if you're subscribed, both at kyrs.org and at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. I was counting down the top stories of 2013, not in any kind of scientific way, just the stories that I noticed the most, that were the most interesting, the most inspiring, the most, you know, promising for what's to come. So there were some bright spots in the kind of dismal weirdness that we're dealing with right now, so in America and around the world. And I realized in listening back to that show that my top story was indigenous resistance to colonialism, to civilization as a model, to fossil fuel extraction as one of those tactics, to capitalism globally, to all the nasty things that I talk about, indigenous-led and non-indigenous solidarity activism that's happening, pointing out that for millions of years, humans lived in a very different way that didn't destroy the planet and wasn't the, you know, the caricature of so-called primitive life that the colonial world would have you believe. So that was huge. And I ended up talking about all the other stories, which were also, you know, interesting to me, but I only saved about 10 minutes for it. So I want to continue there where I left off with Indigenous resistance and share some more, more things in people's own words rather than me giving a, you know, so-so interpretation. One thing I wanted to mention from, I was getting everything prepared here in the studio, listening to Alternative Radio, which just ended with Paul Sanfuegos. That ties into last week's show, my story that I vaguely called, you know, the law is just pretty meaningless at this point. It's pretty clear who the laws are for and who affects them. We saw the community rights movement in Spokane just completely usurped by our so-called representative structure, just smacking down something that a majority of people had followed the process to create what they wanted and were told you can't do that. And there was a Tea Party fellow, if you weren't listening to the show, in the audience who asked Paul, what do we do because people are busy and ignorant. They're distracted and ignorant, and until we get over that, you know, we won't be able to do anything. And this is something that comes up a lot with people talking about my generation, the so-called millennial generation. Also talking about generally like disenfranchised people. You know, oh, they just don't participate, so they don't have anyone to blame but themselves. Paul Sanfuegos put it really well. He said that he has never met an apathetic person, but he's met a lot of people who have given up on using the traditional, the prescribed methods of change, because the people prescribing those methods are the people who need to protect the status quo. They're not going to tell you what method to use that will actually work. He said, if you're a rational person and you've tried to be involved in these traditional ways and they've failed, the rational conclusion is that the system is rigged and that I have to find better things to do with my energy. So I appreciated him adding that in there. I think that in certain communities, this legal route is going to be abandoned as it'll be interesting to see what happens if those towns he's talking about in Pennsylvania secede from their state. Or if, with enough bulk, you know, their state attempts to secede from the union. We've seen what happens when folks try to do that. And no matter what the reason, it'll be interesting. And that might bring this conversation about laws and structure more to the forefront. So that's something going on in 2013 that will likely, well, that will definitely continue into 2014. So continuing this piece about Indigenous resistance, I am going to share part of a video, part of a long and awesome, I haven't listened to the whole thing yet, but I've listened to the beginning, and I want to find the specific point I want to start at, which I should have done before I started speaking. But it's from the Narm Oration, which is an Australian tradition. Every year, the Indigenous communities within Australia and New Zealand come together, and a speech is given, and it's a time for, it's a conference. I don't know a lot about it, but it was in late November. Oh, it was on Indigenous Resistance Day, also known as Columbus Day. No, it was on Thanksgiving. I'm sorry. And I need to find the starting point, and I'll just play it for you. 11:09. So the speaker is Tayayake Alfred, who is a professor from University of Victoria, and he is speaking about being and becoming Indigenous, resurgence against contemporary colonialism. And he does a really good job in this, describing how effective the colonial mentality has been at having folks believe that this is something that happened in the past and it's over. So he talks about that, and I'm going to let him talk about it instead of me, because he's better at it. And then we'll come back and discuss some more Indigenous resistance from 2013.
Central questions, not only for Indigenous people, but I think for all of us who live in countries with colonial histories and colonial presence, which is, how do we transcend the relationships that have gone into forming the societies that we've inherited? How do we transcend the histories of racism, the histories of dispossession, and the histories that encompass injustice, as opposed to the just relationships that we all hope to have in the countries that we inhabit? And in this sense, Canada is no different than Australia. And so I feel I have a connection and something to share with you all in terms of the experience that I've had personally, that my people have had, the people of the Mohawk Nation, and that we in Canada are confronting today collectively as Indigenous peoples, and I'll have to add, as non-Indigenous peoples. If I was here, if I was giving this talk 14 years ago, which is the last time I was in Melbourne, I wouldn't have added that last sentence, that last part, because that's something that's changed in Canada. In the last couple of years, especially in the last year since last winter, we've had a real transformation of the conception of the struggle. Previous to that, I think we were still in this era that was defined in the colonial situation as a us versus them, as a problem that was something of a historical reality of an injustice that needed to be confronted, but confronted by us as Indigenous people. We were defined as the problem. There was even a phrase in academic discourse, I don't know if it's a phrase that you use around here, but the Indian problem. So the problems that our people were suffering, the lack of clean drinking water, the substandard housing, all of the social and psychological challenges that our people face, were seen to be something of a failure on the part of our people to adapt to the natural reality of the development of a modern society. Fortunately, there's a silver lining to climate change. And one of those silver lining to climate change is that people are starting to question the entire basis of Western capitalism and societies that have gone on to develop industrial economies. And there's a little bit of suspicion as to whether or not countries like Canada represent the apex of human civilization. And there may be some trade-offs, and there may be some problems with the way that these societies have been constructed. And one of those One of those realizations that comes from thinking through history in a different way and thinking through the problems that are besetting communities is that people are beginning to recognize that there's some form of responsibility for transforming the fundamental institutions and the fundamental relationships in the society, like a society called Canada, and not necessarily to focus all the effort on redefining Indigenous people or helping Indigenous people overcome challenges to fitting into that larger society. That's a fundamental shift. It is something of a psychic change, but it's beginning to have political ramifications, and it's beginning to have some political manifestations in the way that politics is practiced and in the way that actually change is being constructed in Canada today. So I'm going to focus on that. But first of all, I'm going to back up and really talk about the fundamental concept, which is colonization and my conception of it, and the framework that we use for confronting all of these issues in the world that I inhabit, in the political world that I inhabit in North America, primarily in Canada. Colonization, I think for the general public in Canada, is something of a historical period, if I can say it that way. People think of colonization as a time in the past when ancestors from Europe came and did the things, both positive and negative, that resulted in the formation of the societies that we call Canada, the United States, the Latin American countries, and Australia. People think about it in terms of European peoples coming and with a pioneering spirit, a lot of hard work, a lot of determination, getting a foothold in this continent and developing all of the institutions, the relationships, and in effect, putting the work into developing these societies, which are now paying off in terms of the prosperity and the level of comfortable lives that people have in the situation that we live in today. People think about colonization in the past, and it's true that it is a historic period, and it's a historical phenomenon. Of course, from the 1500s onward in the Canadian situation, people came from Europe and, in effect, dispossessed the Indigenous peoples. Of course, people came from Europe and imposed belief systems and imposed ways of being. Of course, they came with the intent of imposing their own law and their own sovereignty on this area of the world that we call Canada and the United States. Those things happened. And I don't think I need to spend a lot of time demonstrating that or arguing for the fact that colonization and that conception of colonization happened. But the problem in using this framework of colonization as a framework for resolving issues and for understanding issues today and for making arguments today is when people imagine that it is a historical, strictly speaking, concept, where people imagine that over time, because of the development of the society, because of the fact that we are now, as Indigenous peoples, in universities, that we speak English, that we're Christians or post-Christian for most of us, post-Catholic, Catholic, that we in fact drive cars, that we have houses that are single-family dwellings that resemble everyone else's, that colonization is in the past. This is a fundamental problem for us who are still living with the legacy of colonization in terms of the fact that our land was dispossessed, our belief systems and our cultures were disrupted, our families were dispersed, and all of the other things that people associate with that historic era. So the main argument is that if colonization was the intent to take land away, to impose foreign laws, and to disrupt culture, if that would define colonization in the year 1609, it pretty much defines the relationship today, and therefore colonization is not a historical reality, but it's a contemporary political, social, cultural, and psychological framework for the relationship between Indigenous peoples and non-Indigenous peoples in countries like Canada. And in fact, we're not in a post-colonial society. We're in a contemporary colonial society that has, in almost a colonial necessity for the people who are part of the settler state, redefined themselves in terms which allow the settlers to kind of release that burden of the colonial guilt and create new words, new frameworks, new understandings that create a legitimacy for not only their presence on the land, for the things that happened in relation to culture, for the kind of privileges that they claim in relation to Native people and the land and so forth, without acknowledging actually the fact that today these processes are just as vital, just as ongoing, just as harmful, and just as present in the lives of the indigenous population as they were in the 1600s.
And that if you're going to conceptualize. So that is an excerpt from Tayayage Alfred's speech. The NARM oration at the Melbourne Institute for Indigenous Development at the University of Melbourne. He is an activist and a professor from working out of the University of Victoria right now. And I just on Facebook linked to the Praxis page, shared that full speech. And I found it on probably my favorite new news source of the year, intercontinentalcry.org. They do a really good job creating and also, what's the word I'm looking for? Collecting. There's a better word. There's a professional word. Collecting news on Indigenous movements and people all over the world, hence intercontinental. So a really good speech and he has a large body of work on this idea of colonialism happening all the time and adapting all the time. And that's something that I think in general people are becoming more aware of and naming more readily than they have been, that that this isn't an accident, basically. I think that's stolen from Lear Keith, but it's not a misunderstanding. There are people who have intentionally taken power for themselves in various ways, you know, at the end of the day, using violence in some form, violence or threat of violence economically, you know, join us or starve, or if not overtly, you know, when you say violence, when you say state violence, people picture, you know, soldiers marching in the streets and everything, but there's a lot of other forms of violence, colonialism being one of the most historically brutal and currently brutal, if you want to listen to the rest of that. Again, that link is now on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio. So as far as the threats of this kind of ongoing colonialism, as far as the power of the dominant culture to overshadow everything else and to attempt to integrate positive things that people are doing into its identity, all of that's going on amidst this sort of struggle for, you know, the survival of the planet as we know it, as far as global climate change, a very real thing, a really real set of phenomena going on, that's being approached at different levels. So there was an interesting, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because, wow, my time is already fleeting, but The Guardian published a study about just 90 companies cause 2/3 of man-made global warming emissions. And I'll just read this. Suzanne Goldenberg is the U.S. environment correspondent. She says, the climate crisis of the 21st century has been caused largely by just 90 companies, which between them produce nearly 2/3 of the greenhouse gas emissions generated since the dawning of the industrial age. The companies range from investor-owned firms, household names such as Chevron, Exxon, and BP, to state-owned and government-run firms. The analysis, which was welcomed by the former Vice President Al Gore as a, quote, crucial step forward, found that the vast majority of the firms were in the business of producing oil, gas, or coal, which is what this analysis found, which has been published in the journal Climatic Change. Sorry for my involuntary at the name Al Gore. But so I have mixed feelings about an analysis like this. I really like the direction they take it in just a second. But it's like, I think we could have guessed that it's not you and I, though as Americans, like as a class, I suppose we're largely responsible in an indirect way. But you know, me bringing my reusable bag to the grocery store or not isn't what global climate change is hinging on. It's these huge companies who are just doing almost unimaginable damage on a daily basis. You know, we focus a lot when there's a big spill with BP about 4 or 5 years ago now. You know, we focus when there's a big accident. But even when these systems are running as intended, they do unimaginable, like truly horrific damage to the land or water or air or, you know, all three, really, since they're inextricably linked. And that's something that people in the U.S. are realizing as fossil fuel extraction goes domestic. You know, people who were all these drill baby drill people might be eating their words if the drilling is happening near them, especially if it's fracking. So there's a whole community of people who are being kind of mobilized around this. So the part I like about this article, there are thousands of oil, gas, and coal producers in the world. Climate researcher and author Richard Heed at the Climate Accountability Institute in Colorado said, continue, but the decision makers, the CEOs, or the ministers of coal and oil, if you narrow it down to just one person, they could all fit on a Greyhound bus or two. And that, I think, is an interesting, you know, there are individuals making these decisions. There are also sets of individuals who are doing the work. They're obviously, you know, being threatened with poverty, with all of that, all the things that happen to you when you don't have a job. But I think that it's, you know, the time's kind of long past that we need to support people in not taking just any job, not taking a job like that, and helping create other types of ways to support one another on a local level so that we don't get this mass exodus to, you know, North Dakota to help with these extraction projects. When I took the train across the country, took Amtrak, which was vastly delayed by these various forms of fossil fuel traveling, sharing the lines with passenger trains. My trip overall, by the time I reached the East Coast, was 18 hours behind because of directly because of all of this extraction that's going on. I felt like every other person, every third person that I met on the train was taking everything that they had and heading east to work on either at a fracking site or tar sands or traditional oil drilling. And it's just kind of very upsetting. And, you know, I would imagine that since it's dangerous work, it's very toxic work, most of these people would rather do something else. But it's the most lucrative immediate opportunity for them. Still have a responsibility, but I think we should balance it with providing other types of opportunities for people. So 90 companies led by, you know, 90 to 200 individuals are responsible for a lot of this. And here is part of the reaction to that. This ties into the indigenous resistance because a lot of who we'll hear about in one of these categories of this report are indigenous or solidarity activists working with those groups. This is also from Intercontinental Cry. It's actually, the writer is from Inside Climate News. It's reposted here. Her name's Catherine Bagley. And the headline is, Worst Case Scenario for Oil Sands Industry Has Come to Life, a leaked document shows. She says, as environmentalists began ratcheting up pressure against Canada's tar sands 3 years ago, one of the world's biggest strategic consulting firms was tapped to help the North American oil industry figure out how to handle the mounting activism. The resulting document, published online by WikiLeaks, offers another window into how oil and gas companies have been scrambling to deal with unrelenting opposition to their growth plans. The document identifies nearly two dozen environmental organizations leading the anti-oil sands movement and puts them into four categories: radicals, idealists, realists, and opportunists, with how-tos for managing each. It also reveals that the worst-case scenario presented to industry about the movement's growing influence seems to have come to life. The December 2010 presentation by Stratfor, a global intelligence firm based in Texas, mostly advised oil sands companies to ignore or limit reaction to the burgeoning, tar sands opposition movement because, quote, activists lack influence in politics, end quote. But there was a buried warning for industry under one scenario. Letting the movement grow unopposed may bring about, quote, the most significant environmental campaign of the decade, end quote. This worst-case scenario is exactly what has happened, partly because opposition to tar sands development has expanded beyond nonprofit groups to include individual activists concerned about climate change. The more people... Oh, said Mark Flogel, a senior investigator for Greenpeace. He says, quote, "The more people in America see Superstorm Sandys or tornadoes in Chicago, the more they're waking up and joining the fight." Since the presentation was prepared, civil disobedience and protests against the tar sands have sprung up from coast to coast. The movement has helped delay President Obama's decision on the Keystone XL pipeline. A timed election also helped delay that decision. Continuing with the story, designed to funnel Canada's landlocked oil sands crude to refineries on the Gulf Coast, and has held up another contentious pipeline in Canada, the Northern Gateway to the Pacific Coast. The PowerPoint document from Strat4, titled Oil Sands Market Campaigns, was recently made public by WikiLeaks, part of a larger release of hacked files from Strat4, whose clients include the Department of Homeland Security and Defense, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and the American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry lobby. It appears to have been created for Calgary-based petroleum giant Suncor Energy, Canada's largest oil sands producer. I'm going to skip ahead to who these different groups are. For each of Strat4's categories of environmental activists, radicals, idealists, realists, and opportunists, the presentation explains how their campaigns are structured and how the fossil fuel industry could deal with them. Three grassroots organizations, Rising Tide North America, Oil Change International, and the Indigenous Environmental Network, were labeled radicals. Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network were classified as a cross between radicals and idealists. Sierra Club, the nation's largest environmental group, Amnesty International, and Communities for a Better Environment, among others, were labeled idealists. That's funny. Several mainstream environmental groups, including the National Wildlife Federation, World Wildlife Fund, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Ceres, a nonprofit that organizes businesses, investors, and public interest groups, were called realists, probably because they work within the system and attempt to find business solutions to climate change, which in my humble and probably classified as radical opinion is just not possible. So I think that's a breakdown that I would agree with. Strat4 did their research. I should dig into this report and read their descriptions of each of these groups. I bet that they're wishing that more of the environmental movement had remained idealists. You know, oh, if we just explain to them that they're wrong, they'll change their minds. But again, you know, not a misunderstanding. It's people making choices, which they largely understand the consequences of. But, you know, these folks who are kind of taking it to a different level and don't really intend to give up, we'll see what the tactics are for them. So it lays out the tactics, the report, continuing with this story, the groups would use to push for change. They include holding demonstrations outside annual meetings and marketing events, generating fear of oil spills and other environmental disasters, targeting CEOs and their families, collaborating with other green groups, and splitting the fossil fuel industry on the issue by praising companies working with activists and publicly shaming those that aren't. The presentation says that while environmental groups are publicly fighting to stop the expansion of oil sands, their real demand is for fossil fuel companies to adopt a global code of conduct, a set of best practices not required by law, but that take into consideration things like greenhouse gas reduction policies and human rights. I'd say the radical demand isn't really included in this, which the really radical demand on this issue is just stop doing it. Like, no more fossil fuel extraction under any circumstances. Not just nicer, not kinder, gentler expansion. Capitalism / colonialism, just none. So I don't know. We'll be dealing with that. So that report is pretty interesting. I kind of talked about that longer than I meant to, but so this resistance is happening. The industry is planning for it largely, as they do, but it continues to grow. Like the Greenpeace fellow said in that article, the more people see that this is real, it's not something that, as it has for years via, you know, colonialism, one of our handy tools in the power grab toolkit, it's not happening somewhere else. You know, it's not the Middle East being mined for oil. It's not Africa being you know, pillage for resources, which those things are all still happening. But to see it happening in your backyard, unfortunately, is what it takes for a lot of people to realize that it's a real thing. So, yeah. And I think also people have less to lose, or a perception of having less to lose, and everything to either gain or lose, as we have higher unemployment, more young people coming out of college or not having attended because of cost, and just kind of being generally disenchanted. That gives you a nice pool of people to pull from to do something different. You know, it seems pretty clear that we have to do something different. And that is something that I would share. A couple viral videos that I thought were, it was pretty cool that they were viral amongst, you know, all the Miley Cyrus related nonsense and whatever other noise, whatever chatter was going on online. A few things rose to the top despite that. One of them was the really good wealth inequality video that was made, that I'm sure a lot of people listening saw. It's really a visual presentation, which is why I haven't shared it on this show, but it compares what Americans think the distribution of wealth in the U.S. is, what they think it ought to be, and then what it actually is. And it does this with a really nice animation and shows that while people's expectations are that things are not in their favor, the reality is that things are really, 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 really not in their favor. And, you know, it spurned this great discussion of why is it like this and what can we do? Some of it was, you know, not sufficient. It was just, oh, that these really, really rich people should pay more taxes and somehow it'll come to us, which, you know, there are federal programs that directly have helped people. But when the majority of the budget is military and the majority of the folks with sway are these, you know, 90 companies seemingly hellbent on destroying the planet, like, taxes for the rich doesn't seem anywhere near a sufficient solution. So there's others who are really looking at this and trying to figure out, what does it mean? How do we redefine wealth? How do we, you know, render these folks' power obsolete? The small questions being asked in 2013. Another video that I was really, I was both kind of, I found it really entertaining. I found the response really disheartening, but also predictable. I'm only going to play the first minute of it because it really sums up the whole video. This video of Russell Brand, who's an actor, a British actor, kind of not a great guy in his personal life, which was a lot of what the attack was about. But and obviously he's not the only person on earth saying this, but he's one of the only folks with his celebrity status, which gains you a lot in this culture as of now, saying these kinds of things in plain speech. So he was on BBC Newsnight. And this is what he had to say, in case you missed it, and then I'll just rant about it for a small second. If a bell could ring, let the whole wide world sing. Just kidding, that's the wrong switch. But there's some beautiful music for you also.
Russell Brand, who are you to edit a political magazine?
Well, I just suppose like a person who's being politely asked by an attractive woman. I don't know what the typical criteria is. I don't know many people that edit political magazines. Boris, he used to do one, didn't he? So I'm a person with crazy hair, quite a good sense of humour, don't know much about politics, I'm ideal.
But is it true you don't even vote?
Yeah, no, I don't vote.
Well, how do you have any authority to talk about politics then?
Well, I don't get my authority from this pre-existing paradigm, which is quite narrow and only serves a few people. I look elsewhere for alternatives that might be of service to humanity. Alternate means, alternate political systems.
They being?
Well, I've not invented it yet, Jeremy. I had to do a magazine last week. I've had a lot on my plate. But here's the thing that it shouldn't do. Shouldn't destroy the planet. Shouldn't create massive economic disparity. Shouldn't ignore the needs of the people. The burden of proof is on the people with the power, not people like doing a magazine.
How do you imagine
that? So that's just the first minute. But so basically he's saying things that I basically the only main message I ever say on this show, what a lot of other people have said. But, you know, this idea, I think, is starting to fade Maybe it's just my hope that it's starting to fade. But this host, Jeremy Paxman, is basically saying, well, if you don't vote, if you don't participate, then you don't have the right to have an opinion, let alone edit a political journal. And that's something that that I've been broached with quite a bit, but not as much in this last year. Maybe I'm just not speaking to people like that as much as I was, because I'm losing my patience. But it just, even examining it for, 30 seconds. Let's look at it for 30 seconds. It's exactly what Brand said. It's a very limited way to express yourself politically. And if people are political creatures, which is what we're supposed to believe that our nature is, to relate to one another and to develop ways of doing that as, society grows more complex, then it doesn't make sense to then say, and here's the one way that you can play. So I appreciated his bluntness in that, and the reaction to it was, it was predictable. It was, oh, he's an actor, and therefore can't think, apparently, which is just, you only act. Stay over there in your acting box and just act, and don't speak about anything. And yeah, I just thought that was an interesting thing that happened this year. People who, you didn't vote for it, you can't complain. It's like, well, I think people have a right to complain when we don't, you're never offered an opportunity to vote for or against, destruction of the planet. I don't believe for a second that had, folks in the U.S. elected Al Gore, the supposed, climate warrior, against versus George W. Bush, that things would really be much different. You don't get to that point in politics in this country unless you sign on to the basic agreement that endless expansion, good, U.S. military dominance, the way to do it, to get A, you need B, and, capitalism prevails at all costs. If you disagree with those basic tenets, you're not going to get anywhere close. You're not going to get within spitting distance of the president, the presidency, So while he might be like a more pleasant alternative to listen to, an Al Gore versus somebody else, just like Obama might be less offensive for people to listen to than someone who's an outright, bigoted crazy person, his aims are the same, just with a different little flavor. So yeah, I thought that was interesting, and that, 90 million people watched that video is just kind of funny. Comments are disabled on YouTube, which is how a rousing debate has been started and then quickly has devolved into whatever, trolls and nitpicking and abuse and all that. So, yep, that's how you've succeeded in YouTube, is comments are banned, I suppose. Speaking of things being banned, this was also a year of, a vague racial discomfort that is in the U.S. and our culture, bubbling to the surface and becoming less vague by virtue of racial minorities speaking up in this country. Certain groups of, of white people starting to understand the notion of their privilege beyond just in a superficial way, beyond this kind of ritual of, I acknowledge my privilege, but I'm still going to behave in the same way I always have. So one of the really unfortunate ways that the conversation about race was brought to light in the U.S. this year was the Trayvon Martin case. George Zimmerman, being acquitted after stalking a teenager through his neighborhood and shooting him dead, counts as stand your ground. Just today, there is a story related to that. It's just an ongoing strangeness in this country that people have, status quo really wants to defend that that this guy did this and that it was okay to shoot an unarmed teenager. Over the weekend, this story is from Raw Story by Scott Kaufman. Over the weekend, online auction house eBay removed an anti-racist painting critical of George Zimmerman. On the same day, it allowed Zimmerman to sell one of his own paintings for over $100,000. On Saturday, an 18 by 24 inch oil painting by the real George Z, better known as George Zimmerman, was purchased on eBay for $100,099.99. In the question and answer section beneath the auction, Zimmerman even said that, quote, whoever wins within the continental United States will receive this painting delivered by me personally, end quote. Zimmerman's medium is regular household latex paint, which he used because I needed to put these visions onto the blank canvas as soon as possible. George Zimmerman currently owes his legal team over $2.5 million. On the same day Zimmerman's auction closed, eBay removed the anti-racist painting that artist Michael De Antuono had created in the days after the death of Trayvon Martin. 50% of the proceeds from De Antuono's auction were to have gone to the Trayvon Martin Foundation. With 5 days left to bid, the price for the painting had already exceeded $25,000. Then eBay pulled the plug. On his blog, wonders why, quote, Zimmerman was allowed to capitalize on his ill-gotten notoriety, whereas I was denied the opportunity to raise funds to help the very foundation named in honor of Zimmerman's victim. eBay claims the painting violates strictures that items promoting or glorifying hatred, violence, or racial or religious intolerance aren't allowed. Items that promote organizations with these views are also prohibited. That argument's used because in the painting, it's actually not Zimmerman portrayed in the painting. It's a police officer wearing the hood of a Ku Klux Klansman. And eBay says that because it uses that KKK imagery, it's banned. But it sat up there for months. So anyway, you know, we see this ongoing kind of entrenched idea. I talked a little bit about Marissa Alexander last week when I was talking about feminism ascending in 2013. But in a case during the same time frame as George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, Marissa Alexander, who was a black mom, her case displayed the disparity in these laws. She was sentenced after a 12-minute jury deliberation, that's all it took, to 20 years for firing a warning shot into her ceiling as her abusive husband was yelling at her and threatening to kill her. No one was shot, no one was hurt, and she had no criminal history before her arrest, and it took 12 minutes to convict her for 20 years. And in there, there's a graph. So all of this came to light when these two cases converged, and largely, you know, it's been a good educational experience for people in this country who think that, have this absurd notion that it's a post-racial society, and that, you know, electing this guy who's deeply, deeply Washington elite has solved all the problems. It shows that stand your ground laws are the percentage likelihood that killings will be found justifiable. White on black stand your ground crimes are 350 times more likely to be found justifiable by a jury than white on white killings. Black on black are less than 0% more likely. And then black on white are significantly less. You're a lot less likely to be 54% less likely to be found justifiable. So it's measurable within the system. We all got to learn more of the details. Hopefully we can be done learning the details of how our systems are you know, racially biased and racially motivated, and just stop supporting systems that are like that, because it's just clearly not right to anyone who thinks about it for more than a second, and especially to those who experience it every day. In policing matters, stuff locally, which I talked a teeny bit about these issues related to policing when I talked about the laws losing their meaning, if they ever had any, which is a long debate that I didn't really even delve into then. Police accountability is continuing its, you know, 20-odd year march in Spokane. Before I get deeply into the police specifically, I think that Spokane has seen what I would kind of sarcastically label the year of the street kid, if we were, you know, labeling like a mascot for the year. It might be the so-called street kid. The phrase has really surged in use. And there were all kinds of various efforts to, quote, you know, clean up downtown. And what that means is remove these homeless youth and the general vagrancy that happens downtown. Get it out of sight and just get it to go away, the goal, really, has just been to get it to go away, not to really solve the underlying problems, there's been some effort there, but largely what we've heard from the business community is make these darn street kids just go away. So we had, this is vaguely related, but we had the panhandling ordinance and that whole discussion about being able to step into the street to accept money. I did an entire show on that about panhandling and poverty, which you can find back in the archive. And then just last week, after I finished the show, the sit and lie ordinance was expanded to all hours. So the sidewalks in Spokane, don't sit down. Don't, you know, tie your shoe if you look wrong. Don't sit or lie down on the sidewalk in downtown Spokane at any time. And I'd be really curious to see what happened if a lot of, you know, so-called normal people or folks in suits decided to have a little sidewalk picnic or something. Just hypothetically, see if they'd take a rest for that. It's just this idea of criminalizing behavior, because if enough things are crimes, then we can get rid of all these kids. You know, we can just get rid of this blight and this danger that's downtown. And there's been a lot of hysteria about these violent youths, these hooligans and anarchists, as Mike Fagan put it at Monday's council meeting. The hooligans and the anarchists are about. And as far as I know, I was looking at the crime map from the last month and the months before that, that the police department puts together. They mark the type of crime and its precise location by intersection. And there's a density. Downtown Spokane is a high density crime zone, but it's not that bad. Like, crime, violent crime is bad, but when you compare it to cities of similar size, when you compare it to this time last year, crime is low here. And there's a focus whenever anything bad happens that amplifies this notion that downtown is a very dangerous place to be. I've lived downtown for 6 going on 7 years in downtown Spokane. And this is anecdotal evidence. I am a younger person. I don't often anymore, now that I'm not in a professional setting. I don't dress like I have a lot of money to take or anything. But I have never, the most discomfort I've faced downtown is, you know, being catcalled. But that's from, you know, guys in big trucks who obviously, you know, bought their big truck and they're not homeless youth. So the only time I felt endangered is by folks who aren't from around these parts, meaning downtown. You know, there was a video that went kind of local viral from one of the local news stations of a guy getting knocked out by these kids, and it fed into this whole nationwide hysteria about the knockout game, that it's this thing that there's roving, you know, Clockwork Orange-esque gangs of dangerous youths who are just looking for somebody to punch. They just want to test their punching power. And I think it was almost entirely just fabricated based on a few instances. You know, are there kids who are really frustrated? Are there young people who have nowhere to go and are involved in drugs and that is creating dangerous situations? Yes, that's legitimately true. You know, should we figure out something to do about that? Absolutely. But criminalizing behavior hasn't ever worked to solve the behavior problem. Like, it's not, that's not why people stop doing things, is because they're a crime. They stop doing them because they're in a different situation where crime doesn't, you know, need to be a part of their life. So we're not really looking at it that way yet in Spokane. We'll see what happens. In the same meeting on Monday, the same council meeting, there was, what's being called a partial victory, that the issue of police accountability, the ordinance proposed by the mayor, Proposition 1, which was approved by the voters, is being deferred until February. So there's going to be more time to look at it. I mean, I think it's pretty, like, cut and dry. I think you implement what people voted for, but that would be if the laws mattered. So there you go. And So as of now, that ordinance, which has been kind of prepared in defiance of what folks voted for, overwhelmingly over 70% voted for Prop 1, demanding independent oversight from the Ombudsman's office, that's being usurped by the Police Guild, the Mayor's office. And during that council meeting, you know, we talked, a lot of the concern is wanting transparency around the training that's happening for officers, around incidents of brutality, which happen too frequently. And I'm going to play, I did a good show with, it was good because, you know, she was on it, with Liz Moore, who's the director of Peace and Justice Action League, and she's been working on police accountability for years. She's involved with the people who've been working on it while she was, you know, a teenager, when this work was still happening. And I'm going to find the part where she tells a pretty moving story. Not moving, it's a disturbing story, which I guess to be disturbed is a way to be moved. But about an incident that her friend experienced that she also shared at this week's council meeting. And she was told that later the chief of police, Frank Straub, said was untrue. He said that the story was untrue, basically slandered her, I mean, and said that she was lying, and also said that this was true of Joan Medina, who witnessed the death of Josh Levy, which was a, I guess, suicide generated by police tasing this young man who then fell to his death. This is kind of a disturbing episode, but I'm going to play her story for you.
And the other... the other thing I wanted to share is that the one of the agreements that was part of the settlement between AutoZone's mom and them and the city of Spokane was that all police officers would go through 40-hour crisis intervention training on how to deal with people who are mentally ill and or people who are experiencing a psychiatric emergency. And it's part of this really... nationally known program called, which is called the Memphis Model. It's actually featured on Democracy Now, I think on October 22nd, on the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality. And this is the model that had been partially implemented in Spokane previously. Interestingly, one of the tenets of this model is that it should be only officers who volunteer to go through the training, that take part in the training, because those are the folks who are going to have the willingness to learn and the aptitude to apply the new skills that they get out of the training. But the ZEM settlement went further to say, no, every patrol officer has to be trained in this new model. Mm-hmm. And that sets a stage around what the expectations are. Once you've completed a training at your workplace, you are then expected to be able to use the skills. Whether or not you are willing to learn them is not relevant to the expectations that are put on you after that training. And that's a really important change that that AutoZone's family made happen in our community. So right now, they are part of the way through the training. The latest that I know is that all the officers will have completed that training by the end of March, according to the lead trainer. And that's really good. Again, the curtains are so closed, it's hard to tell what changes that's making inside the system, but I do have anecdotal evidence to share. Mm-hmm. And this is that on October 14th, which was 2 weeks ago today, a woman here in town who is a massage therapist and a doula, driving with her children across the Monroe Street Bridge, she saw, and she's given me permission to share this story, she saw a woman sitting on the edge of the Monroe Street Bridge with one leg over. And she said she felt like a force turned her head and made her see this woman. She stopped the car in the middle of traffic. She told her kids to stay in the car. She got out. She waved down traffic. She pointed to the car like she said it was like CPR training. She pointed to the car behind her and said, "You, call 911," pointed to the woman on the ledge. He understood. He was helping block traffic so that her car was safer. And she ran across, jumped across the barricade, and embraced this woman with all the strength that she had in her. to keep her from going over the side. He started talking to her and telling her, I'm not going to leave you. Whatever is happening with you, I will, like, let's go to Denny's and I'll buy you lunch and we'll just talk. And you won't, you're not alone. I'm right here with you. You know, you are loved in this moment. And the woman first tried to go over the edge toward the river. The massage therapist said she used to live in Peaceful Valley, and she knew from experience, she told the woman, if you go over the edge, you really might not die. You'll just get horribly, horribly injured. You know, we see people go over. Don't go that way. Stay here with me. I'm with you. The woman just stayed rather stoic until she said, my kids are in the car. I don't want them to see you die. And that kind of cracked this woman, who then began crying. And she said to her, why are you doing this? You know, why are you trying to end your life? And she said, I'm so cold. I'm so tired. And the woman held her face and stroked her face. And then a police officer grabbed the woman who had been about to go over, pulled her off of the edge of the bridge, threw her on the ground so hard that her face was injured, and handcuffed her. And the massage therapist knelt down and said, I'm with you. I'm not leaving you. You're going to be all right. And then said something to the police officer about, why would you do that? The police officer said into his walkie-talkie, we had a 78 here, and two other officers came along and separated, using their hands, separated the woman from the woman who was on the ground, pulled her away, and basically bullied her into departing from the situation.
So that is Liz Moore recounting this story of her friend, which Chief of Police Frank Straub publicly said was untrue, and also said that Joan Medina's account of watching Josh Levy's death after being tasered and leaving the bridge due to his panic of having the officers gang up on him during a time of crisis, you know, both of those accounts were deemed untrue. These are respected women in our community who have done a ton of work, who have absolutely zero motivation to make up stories like that. Whereas the officers who filed the reports have the motivation of keeping their job, of, you know, protecting this culture, this brotherhood. You know, you see officers stand up and salute Carl Thompson in his trial after he's clearly done wrong and gone above and beyond in brutality in the killing of Otto Zemm. So you see this chief who's supposedly all about reform standing next to these officers' reports, which and being willing to just slander these two women, say that their stories are untrue. And so that's just part of what's going on. You may have seen what I found to be a very tasteless front page photo of police talking a man down from the ledge on Monroe. I don't think that's an image you really need to throw on the front page of the paper, but maybe that's just me being sensitive or something. But so there's a big story, there's a front page story that this training in crisis intervention is paying off. And I think that's great. I think it's great that, you know, while we have a society that has police, which I have feelings about, you know, they should have tools, people tools. That's what in my opinion, the only function that police officers should have is to be like professionally helpful folks who, you know, and everyone in an ideal society would do this. You know, if you see someone who's clearly in crisis, talk with them, try to engage them, try to remind them that they're not alone, that they have, you know, there's a community around them, which shouldn't be a lie. It should be the case that there's a real community for folks. The police talked this man off the ledge, and it's being held up as a great victory. And that's good that folks are being trained to not, you know, throw someone on the ground or taser them as they're engaged in a suicide attempt. But I think that it's meaningless if at the same time the chief of police is willing to just say that these women are lying when they're telling stories of that not happening. It needs to acknowledge that it doesn't always happen, not just throw it on the front page when it does. So running out of time, but, you know, overall, all of this, there's a lot of overwhelming things happening. There is a lot of wrongdoing in the world. There's a lot of people standing up and doing what they can do to fix it. And it's all a choice. You know, we're just making sets of choices, and people with more power, more perceived power, more actual power through violence or whatever means are all making these decisions, and none of it is set in stone. That's the interesting thing. You know, history isn't the only thing we can look to. You can seriously do pretty much anything at any time. And in closing, I'm going to share with you one of my favorite bits from one of my favorite comedians, Bill Hicks. Just a little maybe levity, but also seriousness at the end of the show. I'll be back next week with Van Nielsen. We're going to bring in the new year together on the show, and it's going to be quite good. So hope you tune in. Thanks for listening. This has been Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You can find the podcast at kyrs.org and also at praxisradio509.podomatic.com.